Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of the 909 Podcast is brought to you once again by OneSonic. OneSonic are the only Irish designer of personal audio tech, and they got a deal for 909 listeners. OneSonic are launching their Black Friday sale on Friday 19th of November with discounts off their entire range of earbuds, earphones and headphones. So whether you're looking for your Christmas presents early or you're looking to get new earbuds for yourself, no shade, now is the time. Check out their shop on onesonic.com for the Black Friday sale.
I'm your radio show!
Hello, welcome to the 909 Podcast with me, Andrea Cleary, on my own this week. Niall is away, so it's just us girls as we dive into the theories, the receipts, the scarves, and maybe even the music surrounding Taylor Swift's latest release, Red, Taylor's version. This is the second album from Swift to be re-recorded in its entirety. Earlier this year, she released Fearless, Taylor's version, and this is all due to a quite complicated legal issue regarding the rights to her previous recordings. If you don't know the story around all this, here it is in a very brief nutshell. All of this information has been taken from the YouTube channel Legal Eagle, who made an excellent video about it. Go there if you want to find out more, because it really is a good video. So basically, Taylor Swift lost control of her music copyrights to the first six albums that she made. She released those first six records under the label Big Machine, which is the label that she first signed with. And that was bought by a guy called Scooter Braun. And when that contract was up, Taylor opted not to re-sign the contract. And the label, as you can imagine, weren't happy with that. They refused to allow her to use her songs in a Netflix documentary about her life, as well as banning her from performing the songs on television. So Swift then tried to buy her masters from Big Machine, but Scooter Braun refused to sell them, as well as requesting that she sign an NDA as part of the negotiations. Taylor Swift said no. 17 months later, Braun sold these master tapes to a private investment fund, which is actually becoming more and more common. These investment funds are kind of noticing how lucrative it is to own the masters to a lot of kind of big artists' catalogues. You know, you can look at the value of the Beatles when Michael Jackson bought the rights to that compared to now. Even an artist like Prince had problems with this, which is part of the reason why he changed his name to a symbol back a million years ago. But back to Taylor Swift. These master tapes were sold to this private investment fund, and negotiations just never really got off the ground in terms of her being able to use her music, in terms of her being able to buy back her music. And also, mostly because of these NDA requests, as well as an additional request that she doesn't re-record copycat versions of her songs. Something that she said at the time in a statement she is, quote, both legally allowed and looking forward to doing. Swift then began re-recording the songs. And the reason why she's allowed to re-record those songs is because there's two different licensing issues going on here. There is the composition license, which is the melody and the lyrics, the song itself as it exists on sheet music. And that always belonged to Swift. And the copyright for those kinds of, the copyright and those composition licensing issues usually belongs to the songwriter. But there is also the copyright of the sound recording, which is a separate legal entity, and that belonged to her label. So in order to circumvent the copyright sound recording stuff, all she had to do was re-record the composition. And if she wanted to change it as much as she wanted to, she could do that. If she wanted to get the same musicians in, if she wanted to perform it in the same way, she could do that too. What she did here with Red was basically do a straight re-record of the album. And then she also decided to re-record some of the From the Vault songs that were written at the time, but were never really released. Now, it wouldn't really be fair for me to speak any more about this album, mostly because I wasn't there the first time around. I came to Taylor Swift quite late, as I have done with a lot of pop songs and pop stars. So I spoke to two Taylor Swift superfans who were there from the beginning. And first up is Amelia Cullen, who is the host of the Lately podcast, which you can get on all good podcasting platforms. She is a long, long time Swiftie. And she's going to share her thoughts on the album, on Jake Gyllenhaal, on scarves, on feminism, on neoliberalism. It was a great chat. So I'm going to hand it over to me and Amelia. The first question, Amelia, I have for you is, how are your emotions as a Swiftie?
I feel like they've calmed. I think what's so interesting about this is like it transports you back to where you were when it came out. And I was 22.
So you were 22 when 22 came out.
No, sorry, that's a lie. I wasn't 22. I was 20. But I feel like the album stayed around for those 2 years because that was back when she was only releasing music every 2 years. So those 2 years, 20 to 22, this was like my soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And I was going through a breakup and I was just like, this album speaks to me. Mm. And I think that it just puts you back there and you feel all of those emotions and then a whole host of new ones. Like one of the first things I texted my friend was like listening to Stay, Stay, Stay and realizing that I'm still not in a stable relationship. Really deep.
And when this album was released the first time around, do you remember there being like, were you part of what we are kind of now calling a stand-up? Or what was the experience of being a Taylor Swift fan like the first time around compared to this time?
So I've never been like super collective. Like I've loved her and had a couple of friends who really enjoyed it. And I think we were the perfect age. So I think at that time it was like our getting ready music, our like girly drinks music. And it was just something about like feeling so understood and that it was like upbeat. But then there was the sad songs and it just kind of filled the hundreds of emotions that you were feeling every hour of the day when you're in your young, like when you're that young trying to figure out who you are, and it just kind of spoke to you. And then when I moved to the UK, I did my friend group there, everyone loved Taylor Swift, and that was the first time of really feeling like, okay, cool, there's a lot of people. It's not just like my friends would always kind of like, oh, it's kind of weird that you're so into Taylor Swift, where like going there and finding a group of people and being like, see, these are some of the coolest girls I know, this like badass bunch of girls from New Zealand, and then being like, and they also love Taylor Swift. So
So there wasn't as much of a kind of a visceral stand-em, I suppose. And I mean, I know you're not involved with the stands at the moment, but how do you think being a Taylor Swift fan has kind of changed from then to now? Because now there's a kind of a, and I'm aware that maybe they'll listen to this, and I really want them to understand that I love them and I think they're great, and I love Taylor, but there is a kind of association, particularly with Taylor Swift stans, with being very militant online, and being quite gatekeepy. And I'm wondering, as somebody who is in their late 20s, how do you feel as a Taylor Swift fan going from the early days to now and seeing that shift in the fandom?
I think it's kind of something that I just see is happening and I'm putting over there. I don't engage with it. And I think it's something really interesting when you look into fandom that, you know, multiple fandoms you're seeing this happen. It's not just here, like we saw with One Directioners, and it is really like aggressive. Once again, I love her, so please don't come for me. But I think it's very hard to kind of understand as someone who's just never, I like respect her so much as an artist. Her music is always related to me. I, you know, have judged the men as much as anyone. But I think like the way that they come for journalists and come for people like that, I just think isn't something that she condones herself. And I think that's what I always find interesting when you look at like that element of fandom, that like, it can reflect badly on the artist because they get the push, they get a pushback, but they're not in any way directing that kind of action or that kind of vitriol. So it's kind of.
And Taylor's always been a little bit, so she's always taken a bit of a backseat when it comes to, I mean, it feels strange to say now when it comes to her own narrative, because that's not true at all. But as in, she didn't speak out about politics until the 2016 election, for example. And she didn't really recognize her position within kind of gay fan bases until, you know, the music video with the hate doesn't make you any less gay. What was that lyric? Something, shame never made anybody less gay in You Need to Calm Down, maybe. You can tell I'm coming at this as an outsider, but as somebody who only really loves 1989. But she has always kind of taken a backseat when it comes to that. Has she ever, I don't think she's ever actually addressed the stand-up before, or am I wrong there?
No, I don't think she has. And I think that it comes a lot from obviously like her country background and how country stars are polished and trained, and that's why she has been slow to comment on all those things, because it's all a part of her like evolution from like good girl of country to like independent female musician, and all those things are wrapped up in that. And she only ever speaks positively about her fans, and I think it's something that she kind of is a bit out of sight, out of mind on, because she does have such a good relationship with her fans, like you know, listening parties and all of those. And you know, those fans who she engaged with, I don't think she's ever seen those characteristics up front.
Yeah, that's probably right, because I doubt that she's manning her own social media accounts, you know. You mentioned the men a moment ago. This is something that I'm not familiar with at all, and I feel a bit ignorant of. What I've seen is Jake Gyllenhaal. I've seen his name thrown around a little bit about this album. So I can see you're doing stretches, you're gearing up, you're ready to tell me all about this.
No,
tell me what's going on with the men on this album then and now, I suppose.
Well, I think what I think is so interesting about what's going on then and now is she's getting a lot of pushback that I've seen in recent days of people being like, oh, why are you dragging him through the mud? But she's never... Now, she's made some very opaque statements that kind of push people in that direction. But like, she's never outright said it was about him. So she's not directing anything at anybody. And this is like...
This is what part of that Stan thing, right?
The
codes and the hidden messages.
Exactly. And she plays into that, yes, but that's because it's very commercially successful. And that, you know, why I love Taylor Swift was because she was putting it all out there. And like, obviously, the evolution of her songwriting has like developed and it's not all as clear cut. And that's kind of why the Easter eggs and all that kind of stuff became more predominant. But what I loved about her initially was like she was writing about her feelings exactly how they happened and in real time. She was going through these relationships, she was putting out the album. She was going through these relationships, she was putting out the album. And that's what happens, I think, when you're a singer-songwriter and you're that young, when you're starting writing at 16, 17, she was writing this album 19, 20, 21. And so then I think it was a lot of speculation and it did serve her career very well because like with Speak Now and, you know, that was mainly about John Mayer and Taylor Lautner and that kind of got a bit of an attention. And then this, you know, with Connor Kennedy, Jake Gyllenhaal and Harry Styles, it did boost her kind of like media persona, but for good and bad. She got a lot of pushback and a lot of, you know, subtle and not so subtle misogynistic comments.
There was a lot of kind of music journalists, male music journalists, who would be kind of making little snippy comments about her not being able to. I mean, Adele kind of had a similar thing happen as well, although the narrative is slightly different as we kind of roll up to her release this Friday. But the idea that women or women like Taylor and Adele can't write music unless they've had their heart broken, as if men or, you know, even male country music stars, male pop stars aren't doing the exact same thing, or in the case of people like Harry Styles when they were dating, having their songs written for them. So yeah, that was always a very interesting aspect to the kind of the media's relationship with Taylor Swift, certainly in the early days. I do think it's shifted now to them seeing her as this sort of robotic, you know, capital queen and the kind of capitalistic girl boss thing, which we might get onto in a minute. But yeah, so she was writing these songs about these men at this time. What is the scarf for our listeners? Where does the scarf come in on the album, and what makes people think it belongs, or that Jake Gyllenhaal has a scarf that belongs to Taylor Swift?
So there's a couple of interesting things here, because they had a very short-lived romance, and it was, you know, there's a few kind of like paparazzi images that plot out the timeline and that coincide with the lyrics in the song, and then obviously really coincide with the short film and the 10-minute version. And some people think that the scarf is a
this
metaphor.
Is All Too Well, the which you can view on YouTube if you look for All Too Well short film Taylor's version, 10-minute version. It's called all of those things.
It's the best way to spend 10 minutes. But some people believe that it's a metaphor for her virginity. But there's also paparazzi photos of her and Jake Gyllenhaal out, and she's wearing a scarf. And then a couple of days later, he is out wearing that scarf.
Oh my God.
So then the song comes out and the lyrics in it. So obviously everyone went crazy. And I
So did this song come out at the time? So how did that work?
That's so important to note about All Too Well is it was never a single. It was just like one of the quite far down tracks, but it summed up that relationship that so many people are in. The kind of, we didn't even have, you know, gaslighting wasn't a word that was thrown around in our conversations like it was, but that's what it signified, that kind of, you know, knowing about a relationship but feeling kind of just tricked constantly and just the short-livedness of it. And it kind of just really connected with a lot of people, and the melody is really beautiful and emotional.
It's a very good song. I heard it for the first time when I watched the 10-minute version on YouTube. And so, I actually kept feeling like I switched it off after a few minutes because I kept getting a bit distracted from the song by the short film, which is excellent. But when I listened to the song then, I was really like, wow, this is it's a beautiful melody. It's a beautiful song.
And so the fans loved that song. And she said in interviews that it went from being a song that she would have to take a break to cry after to being one of her favorites, because everyone was getting behind it and everyone would sing it back. And I'm not sure of the timeline, but it was pretty clear based on the timeline and the age difference that it was about Jake Gyllenhaal. And the 10-minute version, which is obviously quite self-indulgent.
Yes. Yeah, we should state that.
As is the 2-hour album. Like, the whole thing is indulgence. But, like, it's for the audience who soaked it all up. And that's what the 10-minute version is. And it adds so much more context. It makes the whole thing seem so much more heartbreaking. And the video essentially, in a way, kind of spells out exactly what you'd envisioned in your head. And, you know, Dylan O'Brien plays...
Who doesn't look, like, dissimilar to Jake Gyllenhaal in that he's, like, a handsome white man, I suppose. But, you know...
Exactly.
He's clearly playing Jake Gyllenhaal in this thing, yeah.
So he plays him, is the credit given, and Sadie Sink plays her. And the entire video just ties together all these little snippets and hints in other songs as well. So The Moment I Knew, which is about, you know, her 21st birthday party and he didn't turn up. Sitting by the Water. Like, there's just all these little hints and tricks. But the thing is, like, she's never going to outright say it.
No.
And
well, Taylor Swift doesn't outright say anything.
Exactly. And so it's just really been, like, a cultural moment of people just jumping onto it now, and back to the toxic kind of stardom of people like jumping on Jake Gyllenhaal, which I don't think is necessary. I think that, like, you know, it represents just a relationship with a man, especially an older man, and just kind
Taylor
of
was 20 and he was 27, I believe. Is that true? Yeah. Or 29? One or the
29,
other.
29, I think. It was nearly 10 years, because one of the new lyrics is, I won't get it right exactly, but it's something along the lines of, I was never good at telling jokes, but here's the punchline: I'll be getting older while your lovers stay the same age. And naturally, someone on TikTok made a chart that laid it out that that's exactly right. That, like, there's been essentially a bouncing 10 to 15 year age group gap between most of his relationships. So
the Leonardo DiCaprio issue of refusing to date a woman over 25, despite him being, you know, in his 40s or 50s or whatever he is these days.
But yeah, I think that people have really latched on to the Jake Gyllenhaal, and I do feel bad for him, because I think it is because people love the song so much. Where I think, like, you know, Connor Kennedy features as well, and there's, you know, kind of Holy Ground, which is supposed to also be about Joe Jonas, because it's about looking back on a relationship with, like, distance. And I do think the thing about Taylor is that, like, they don't necessarily have issues with it. Like, Jake has never spoken against it, and again, it's all kind of rumor, but there's lots of rumors that, like, you know, he still listens to Taylor Swift, and, like, she said in an interview that, like, whoever one of the songs was about, like, told her that it was like looking through a photo album. Now, I think that could either be Harry Styles or him, just based on my own parasocial relationships and who I've decided they are. But she said that was so much nicer than, like, getting a horrible email, which was definitely John Mayer. Me slandering men left, right and center. But
look, I mean, I think, like, we don't know these men, but of those three men, John Mayer is totally the guy who's going to give the annoying email that, excuse me, how dare you? Especially because he's such a songwriter, you know, where, you know, Jake's not at all. And Harry is, you know, he is a songwriter, but he also gets it, you know.
And I think as well that the thing is that, like, all of the albums and all of the songs, yes, they are about specific people, but the nature of songwriting is they're all amalgamations from all of those relationships and all of those feelings added together. So you can't tarnish one person in particular. I do really enjoy as well that she has Phoebe Bridgers on the album, because I think it's really interesting.
Let's talk about Phoebe Bridgers' song, because that is, for my money, the best of the new tracks. As beautiful.
I would agree. I think it's stunning, and I think it's really interesting, and to have for the content of the song to be about a newcomer coming over and fearing that they'll take your place, for her to then have someone who is younger than her and kind of show, look, we can both coexist, and also someone who is, who has publicly had a relationship with a much older man that had a profound impact on her that we all know and don't know about.
Yeah.
So I think I really enjoyed that element of it. And it's just a great kind of like sad girl bop.
It is. It's a beautiful song. On the sort of mythology of Taylor Swift and how we, even the fact that we know to an extent who these songs are about, what do you think it is that Taylor's doing in order to kind of pepper her music, and I think particularly lately, her kind of visual element to her songs with these hints? And also, like, how does that work in terms of perhaps taking you out of the song a little bit and causing you to direct feelings and anger towards an actual human man instead of maybe the platonic ex-boyfriend that exists in all of our heads who we're still angry with but we never actually dated, do you know?
Yeah, I think that part of it does come down to obviously a real commercialization because, you know, there's a lot more merch, it's a lot more specific, there's a lot more to engage with, and I do think that you can look at it through that lens. But I also think that it comes down to the fan base and what they're willing to devour and the time that they're willing to put in. And
I think devour is a very good word to use, because I think if Taylor puts a drop of blood in the water, then they are on it.
I think she learned a lot from, you know, Folklore and Evermore and the way that they were released and the reaction and reception to them. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, like, these, the re-releases are about regaining control. And I think that then all of these other elements are kind of just playing to that. And also the culture we live in, like, video is so important. Video and snippets and all of that stuff. So I think that she has a very smart team around her, and I think she's very clever herself.
I feel a little bit when it comes to the kind of peppering things with little hints and hidden messages and decoding. I think that's kind of been part of Taylor since Reputation. I think Reputation was that at its most. Reputation for me didn't work because it was too much of that, and I don't think the songs were good enough to kind of justify the winking and the nodding. And then with Lover, she seemed to pare that completely back, and that was an album that was just about the songs, I suppose, and it wasn't really about pointing fingers anywhere in particular. That album didn't work because there wasn't enough of the winking and the nodding in it. And then Folklore and Evermore came out, and I felt like she hit on a real sweet spot there, where the hints and the winks and the hidden messages were all self-contained within the albums. Like, it wasn't really pointing to anything outside of those records. The songs are pointing to each other, and, oh, is there a trilogy? And is this a character that's running through the whole album? And I really think she hit on that. And I'm wondering now with Red, is she like placing herself back as an older person now, more learned, happy in a good relationship, a good stable relationship, and she's placing herself back in the time when she was writing this? Is she leaning a bit too heavily on what worked, or what she felt worked with Reputation, and drumming up gossip, I suppose? Or is it a kind of a goodbye to that era? I don't know. I'm not suggesting one or the other, but
I would know. I think it's a very interesting point, but I do think that this album, this and 1989, I think are the albums that had, until obviously Evermore and Folklore, that had the real wide appeal that really showed, you know, this was like the real getting her foot in her evolution as a musician, and kind of she ditched out
a
bit
pop
with
star.
Yeah, and you know, and I think, you know, Reputation definitely was a dip in this, and I think that then she's come back around with the last two albums of understanding songwriting and making music and the polish and refining it. And I think that's what you see on this album. You know, there's very few, you know, musical changes to it.
Mm.
It is just, you know, a more polished version with essentially a second album attached.
Yeah.
And I think that she just knows that, like, she can have fun with it, how much it means to people, how much people have already deep dived into it. And it's kind of like, why not run with it? I think also some of the, like, Easter eggs that people are finding are just, like, far-fetched. Mm. But I think, to a degree, people are just having fun with it.
Yeah, I think it's quite difficult to read things into a Taylor Swift album that she doesn't want you to read into them. Later in the episode, we'll be hearing from Kelly Doherty, who's going to explain to me what Gaylor is. Gaylor, okay. Have you heard about that?
Yes, I'm yeah. excited to listen.
So that is the theory that Taylor Swift is actually a queer woman and has been all along. So do stay tuned to hear from Kelly Doherty about that, because we're all excited. All the gals are excited for Taylor Swift to be gay. That's all I want, really. And so when it comes to the actual re-recordings of the songs that were already released, what kind of differences are you noticing? I know there weren't very many in the last release, but there was, I mean, I remember just a couple of things in Love Story, especially, like, jumping out at me. I listened to 22 just before we started recording to see if I could hear anything, except for maybe just her voice is better than ever. But I think that Red was already a more mature Taylor Swift than Fearless was at that time. So I don't know how much of a difference there is. What did you notice any differences, or did you notice more of a polish?
I just noticed more of a polish, definitely refined. I think there's obviously some things are a little louder, some things are a little quieter, but overall it just feels cleaner, if that makes sense. Obviously now she changed Girl at Home, which I actually really liked the original version, but a lot of people didn't. So it's a lot more like pop synthy, which, you know, I think is fine, but I did like how it was before. But that's the only like dramatic change, I think. Everything else is just, I don't know if it's just, I think also on some of the other ones there's maybe slightly more like treacherous. I think there's like a few more strings. It just feels a little bit more heavy. Maybe that's just me projecting my own emotional relationship to that song onto it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because I think that with Fearless, what I got from the album overall was a much better sense of warmth and kind of a much better sense of communication between the musicians. Like, everything was being hit right away, which I thought was really great to kind of hear her. And I also really liked hearing her recording those songs as a grown woman. Like Love Story is such a ridiculous song. Like, it is, I absolutely adore it, but what a incredibly melodramatic song for a grown woman to sing. And I do think that she had a lot of fun doing that. And I kind of felt that way about 22. I think something that's so clever about 22 is the lyrics in the chorus kind of allow you, and this didn't occur to me until now, those lyrics allow you to dance to that song and to celebrate that song no matter what your age is, because it's dancing like we're 22. It's not that we are 22, it's like we're 22. And I just kind of feel like there's such mastery in that. Like, she's writing songs that are about very specific things, whether it's men or ages or locations or whatever it is. But she's always making sure to have the mass appeal there to make sure that everyone can bop to the songs.
You know? Oh yeah, she's an incredibly clever songwriter. I also do think that in all of the songs that have any little hints of where she speaks, or even some of them afterwards where she's like, that was so fun. Like, there's a little almost like a, wink and a nudge of like the way she says it's a little just bit more kind of like, ooh, fun, you know?
Yeah.
Where it had been a genuine like, oh, that was so fun the first time.
There's the funny bit in 22 when she says, who's Taylor Swift anyway, ew, which at the time obviously meant, you know, who's Taylor Swift anyway? She's not a pop star yet. She's just some country music girl. But the way she delivers it now is just so outrageous, because who doesn't know who Taylor Swift is? Nobody doesn't know who Taylor Swift is. So I do think that she's having fun with this. I also think that she's taking it very seriously, and I think that she should take it very seriously, because this is, after all, kind of born out of a legal battle, and the idea that she has to re-record these things because her songs were taken away from her, and that sucks. I wanted to ask you about Taylor Swift's feminism. You and I have had conversations about feminism over drinks, and I wanted to bring that vibe to the podcast. Where are you with Taylor Swift right now as a feminist, as this fuck the patriarchy keychain idea?
Well, that's a great question. I think I'm at, so a large part of my dissertation that I did for my master's was about pop culture feminism. And so
I'm very happy I asked you this question then.
Trying to kind of negotiate and understand the value of all types of feminism, and when feminism is so tightly wrapped around capitalism, what benefit can it have? And you know, there's always, you know, there's no ethical consumption under capitalism, which is true. So it's kind of like, is it tarred with the same brush? There's no ethical feminism under capitalism, because capitalism is a tool of the patriarchy. So while on one hand I agree with that, on another hand, I think that we live in a world where when you are particularly online, if you were in a particular social group, social standing, echo chamber, for a better word, you can think that feminism is fixed. I'd love to be in that echo chamber personally. You think that we have nowhere to go. There's so many different levels of what you think is needed for feminism can be there. But I think that there's a huge amount of people who still think we don't need feminism in the first place, or think that we've already achieved it, and don't connect, you know, there's so many people that don't connect problems in their everyday lives with the greater issues that are creating them, you know, like so many people who don't know what neoliberalism is, so still live by its principles, even if it's crippling their everyday experience. And I think that because of that, whatever form of supporting female empowerment that she gives can only have good. Would I like some more nuanced lessons of feminism to come from her? Sure, I'd love for everyone to give more nuanced lessons in feminism, but she's not going to do that. As I said earlier, it's very much comes down to her upbringing, her training, living in Nashville. Like, she's unpicking all of those elements and uncovering who she is socially and politically and sharing what she's willing to of that. And I think that there's an element of having to like embrace people where they're at.
Yeah, I think so, because I think something very important with Taylor Swift is that the venue and the world in which she performs her feminism, or is a feminist, is her working world, which is the entertainment industry, which is an extremely patriarchal zone to be working in. So the things that she can do through her work have an inherently capitalistic edge. I think with Taylor, it is a particularly capitalistic edge. I mean, while on the one hand, I am very, very much supportive of what she's doing in terms of re-recording these albums, from a feminist perspective, in that I want her to own her work and I want her to earn money from her work. But on the other hand, there is this gnawing idea in the back of my mind, which is, don't you have enough money? And it's not that I think it's okay for men to own her things, the rights to her recordings, but I just also don't believe maybe that re-recording these albums is the grand feminist statement that she thinks it is. And I think that's okay, but because I don't know if she's, but maybe it's some of the language around it that she has used that makes me uncomfortable with this being a feminist statement.
Yeah, I think that so much of it comes down to her personal perception. And I kind of, I agree with everything you said. And I think on one hand, it's kind of like, okay, well, yes, it is important to show a message that when a man takes something from a woman, when, you know, shady deals go on in the background, which happens to women everywhere, every day in the gender pay gap, where people are unaware how much less they're being paid than their male counterparts.
And I should say, too, that this happens to artists of color as well. It's the reason why Prince had to change his name to a symbol for a little while there. Was the same thing as this.
Exactly. And I think that so that overall message is positive. Would I love to, I don't know, like see her tax returns or see, you know, the Taylor Swift Foundation with the profits of these albums? Mm. Oh, nothing would please me more. Maybe we live in hope and we watch this space. Mm. But also it does, you know, she obviously has a lot of money, clearly. But I'd also be intrigued to see, based on how easy it was for that situation to unfold, to know how much she was getting in the original deal. Because I think it is obviously much more than you and I will ever earn.
Yeah,
but I don't know if it's as much as we always think it is.
Yeah, I think the problem with the original deal was that they wouldn't let her use her music because she had previously requested, after she finished her six albums, she requested to buy her masters from them and they wouldn't let her. And it seems, obviously we don't have the depositions or whatever, but it seems to be that they took issue with her wanting to end her record contract and wanting to buy back those masters. And basically just banned her from, I mean, like that documentary that she did, she couldn't use her own music in it, which is wild because all of that kind of legal stuff was going on. So I do think, I mean, there's a bit in her, who is it that does it? You know, is it the New York Times or those 21 questions with things that you see on YouTube? And it's like, they're following the person around.
The 90 questions with Vogue.
90 questions with Vogue. Yeah. In her one of that. The guy behind the camera says, what advice do you have to somebody who wants to be a musician? And just like that, and I know these things are probably rehearsed, but like that, she just says, get a good lawyer. And I think that for the lack of the Taylor Swift Foundation, which I do think would be a wonderful thing for her to kind of put this kind of issue and everything that she's drawing attention to in the music industry, I think that would be a wonderful thing for her to do. I do also think that she is changing this forever. Like there's not going to be a record contract that's being signed from pop musicians from now on that isn't going to have some kind of Taylor Swift clause in it, which I do think is amazing. And that's the feminist thing, I think, do you know?
Yeah. And I think it is amazing because I think if you talk to any like working musician or singer songwriter, like the way that, you know, streaming and all of that stuff has destroyed their profits, it can only work in their favor to have more control over their music.
Yeah, the very interesting thing about the about Taylor Swift and streaming is that her music wasn't on streaming platforms for a really long time because of her ethical issues with Spotify. And then in pure Taylor Swift fashion, she releases them all on the day that Katy Perry's album is being released. And nobody listened to Katy Perry and everybody listened to Taylor Swift, and it was Taylor Swift Day and everyone was very happy. So I do think that she is kind of malleable in her morals from time to time. Is Taylor Swift a problematic fave? I think that's what I'm getting towards here. Because I do love her and I root for her, but I find her endlessly frustrating.
Yeah, I think sometimes she does think sometimes that are things that you think, oh, I'd love to do that. But like in the version that happens in your real life, you don't, because it's not nice or mean.
Mm, mm.
And I think that, you know, once again, we don't know anything about her. And I honestly say this with truth. I would love to go on a night out with Phoebe Bridgers. Phoebe Bridgers, mm. Paul Mescal and me hitting a few pints. Great time. I don't mm-hmm. think I'd want, I just don't know if me and Taylor would vibe.
Mm. But I think maybe the version of Taylor that never got famous.
Exactly. Yeah, I just don't think she'd be sitting in the pub with us on Saturday.
Mm. Yeah. Very different chats to someone like Gaga. You know, yeah. Taylor is kind of more like a Beyonce. It's like, I don't know what to say to you. I love you and I don't know how to talk to you.
And also, I think so much of it is not her fault, because she was so young when she became so famous.
Yeah.
That her life, and this is what I think as well, that informs a lot of her action. She lives in an environment and in a world that we do not know. It is not, she does not live in real life. She obviously very much cultivates a privacy now with her relationship. And I think she obviously has a huge level of normality in that. But like anyone who exists on that level of fame, your checks and balances and, you know, the people providing your feedback are vastly different. So your reactions and your behavior is vastly different.
Hmm. Yeah.
I'm just an apologist. Apologist for the celebrities.
Yeah. No, but I mean, like we said earlier, they move and work in a realm that is both incredibly like politically and culturally and socially influential, while also being completely, you know, void of context for those things. You know, like Taylor Swift can absolutely go to a women's march. I don't know if she did, but she can absolutely go to a women's march and sing a song there, or, you know, tweet that she is in support of it. And that is the role that she is going to play in it. And that will have a huge, huge impact. But when it comes to actually kind of engaging, I suppose, it's a completely different world with pop stars. And I think that that's why it's very difficult to kind of get your head around the expectations that we have of them. But I think that those expectations, especially with Taylor Swift and especially with feminism, is because she is using it in her music and she is cultivating the, what was it, Sarah? Amelia and I had drinks the other night, the girl boss Funko Pop that Sarah mentioned. You know, this girl boss energy and this, you know, that is inherently tied up with the American dream. I worked hard. I called out the men in my life. And a lot of times women don't have the opportunity to do that. And
there probably, like you said, there's probably a real essay in like Taylor Swift, the neoliberalist dream. And like, I just don't want to read it or write it because I'd be confronted. Yeah.
I certainly don't want to write it. I 100% want to read it. And good luck to anyone who gives it a go, because it is tough out there to criticize Taylor Swift. And just in case any people are listening who might take issue with what Amelia and I are saying, we're sorry, and we do love Taylor and we love you stans. Let's just say that on top of all of this. Amelia, is there anything you'd like to add about your experience listening to Red over this past little while, or anything about Taylor?
Okay, well, there's actually one thing that came to mind, which I think is interesting to note, given the earlier conversation about the men who feature and you kind of like the how dare she drag this all up, is that she has great relationships with a lot of her exes. There is great footage of her and Harry Styles having a hug at the Grammys.
Which I love.
Which we love. Her and Joe Jonas, she sent it, like as she wrote in the lyrics, you know, she sent his baby a present. Sophie Turner, his wife, was wearing all her merch. Like, I feel like, you know, people are very okay with it. They're all fine. So, you know, yes, she'll be turned down the hate towards them for things they did 10 years ago. But also, we don't know their relationships anymore. Like, I doubt her and
these people
Jake
are characters going, in a film. You know, they're not, to us, they're not real people.
And then for me personally, I just think that on a grander scheme, it's terrible that she's had to re-release all this music, but I think it's brought a lot of nostalgia and joy and just enjoyment to people's lives at a time when, you know, this pandemic is really dragging on and we needed it. And like, yeah. I am that old person on TikTok, and that's what my For You page, which is usually a very different space, became quickly filled with, you know, people driving around screaming Taylor at the top of their lungs, as I have been for the entire weekend.
Yeah, when I saw you, you pulled up in your little car and this album was blaring out of your speakers. So that was a huge moment to just see you in your joy like that.
Exactly. And people, you know, so many people traveling, you know, especially in America, like traveling across the country to have Taylor Swift weekends with their friends and people going to listening parties. And I just think it's just an unadulterated good time. Great listen. If you haven't, you're missing out. And I think that, you know, great for her as well, because of all of the criticism that she received when it first came out, that it's kind of that concept that's so popular in pop culture now of like, everyone's been sleeping on teenage girls, like they are cultural tastemakers.
Yeah.
And what they enjoy has value. And I think it's great to see like that come back around.
And to see those girls grow up into women who maybe have, I mean, not that teenage girls don't have the language with which to speak about pop music and pop culture, but to grow up into women who have the maybe a better understanding of that language and how to communicate it to people and be like, no, this is actually important.
And who have context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And they've lived through it. Yeah. Well, Amelia, thank you so much. That was
lovely.
Thank you.
This was an absolute joy.
You can listen to Amelia's podcast Lately on all good podcasting platforms. If you enjoyed this chat, I would recommend seeking out the chat with Jen Gannon about our internet boyfriends, because one Mr. Gyllenhaal makes a little cameo there, and I wouldn't be surprised if Amelia went back and edited that out. But thank you, Amelia.
Much to drink tonight, and I know it's sad, but this is what I think about. And I wake up in the middle of the night. It's like I can feel time moving. How can a person know everything at 18 but nothing at 22? And will you still want me when I'm nothing new? Crying in my room when you can't blame it on my youth and roll your eyes with affection.
Thanks so much to Amelia for that chat. You can listen to her podcast Lately on all good podcasting platforms, and I'm even on one of the episodes, so you can go and find that as well. In the Niler 9 Discord, which you can get access to at patreon.com/Niler9, I did it. Kelly Doherty, who's a journalist and a musician, was telling us all, educating us all basically, about Taylor Swift standom and all of the different theories and ideas that have kind of cropped up around this album, which are really fascinating. So if you haven't like dived in, you might have seen things about a scarf, about Jake Gyllenhaal, about a keyring that says fuck the patriarchy. And I was finding it hard to make head nor tails of this, so I asked somebody who knew. Here's Kelly Doherty.
So for better or for worse, I found myself deeply inextricably linked with the world of Taylor Swift fan theories. It's an amazing, extensive world where everything has a deeper meaning and nothing can be taken lightly. So I guess kind of, I've been a Taylor Swift fan for a very long time, since I was a kid. I've never really been someone who's too into like the fan theory sides of things, just enjoyed music. But I think with Taylor Swift, it's kind of unavoidable once you get past a certain point of enjoying her music. If you consume any type of content about her on social media, you just end up falling into this kind of rabbit hole. So yeah, I have far too much information that I can never use for anything of any particular use. I suppose in terms of fan theories, the ones that are kind of the most important right now in this Red Taylor's version era would generally be all the fan theories around who Red is about, and all of the different subsections of who Red is about. So obviously the biggest theory is that it's about Jake Gyllenhaal, which I think is pretty much confirmed at this point. And yeah, but then there's even more to focus on within that. So in the new version of All Too Well, there's a reference to an actress comforting her after her breakup with Jake Gyllenhaal. And there's deliberation online at the moment as to whether that actress is Jennifer Aniston or Anne Hathaway. And everyone has different arguments and receipts for who it may be. But it's kind of, I suppose, with Red at the moment, that's the overwhelming thing is people just kind of combing through all the details and trying to piece together what they think the real life events are from the album. I think something like that's probably like pretty natural to happen, particularly with someone like Taylor Swift, whose relationships have been so public. And from the start of her career, even with tracks like Dear John, people knew they were about John Mayer and stuff. So I suppose that's kind of like the obvious top tier level of hypothesizing around the albums, but it gets much, much deeper than that. I think the first big Taylor Swift fan theory that I ended up getting sucked into was the world of Gaylor. So it's all of the fan theories as to whether or not Taylor Swift is, in fact, a queer woman. She has, in recent years, done an interview where she has said, "I do not consider myself to be a part of the queer community," but that has not stopped fans. So I guess over the years, there's been rumors of her having relationships with Karlie Kloss and Diana Agron, who are both good friends of hers, or were a bit good friends of hers. And they kind of just spiraled. So I think there was like few pieces of what would be considered evidence. There was like a few photos of them and kind of stuff like that. But online now, there's extensive PowerPoint presentations about the relationships and proving exactly why they are true. So there's like a mega presentation you can find online on Tumblr, of course, that's like over 100 slides giving all of the receipts as to why Taylor was with both Diana and Karlie. And then with pretty much every new album that Taylor Swift releases, it's accompanied by a presentation from fans about what pieces of the album, what references in the album are actually about Karlie Kloss. So it's an extensive world. I think it's interesting, I guess, with this fan theory, like as a hardcore Taylor Swift fan and a gay woman, it's fun. I think it's a fun fan theory to buy into. I'm never really sure if anyone who actually says it necessarily believes it or really, yeah, I suppose it's kind of one of those things. I don't know if people actually believe it or not, but they have fun with it and kind of finding those Easter eggs. And I think, you know, it's kind of one of those things that it's kind of the line in between like toxic fan culture of like maybe isn't the best thing to speculate on someone's sexuality who's an actual real life person. But I think particularly with like queer music fans and queer fans of pretty much any type of media, it's part of tradition and history to speculate around sexuality and gender, because we have been given so little material over the years to actually work with. So people tend to take their own meanings. And I suppose with stuff like queer coding over the years, queer fans have particularly been taught to like read into things, because so often that's what you have to do or else you're never going to find yourself represented and stuff. So I think there's negatives around speculating on people's sexuality, but I do think it's a fun section of fan theory that I always enjoy anyway. And I think, I suppose with Taylor Swift as well, I think with the Easter eggs and the fan theories, like it is something that she buys into and that she is very aware of. like she said a lot in interviews, she's always left Easter eggs for her fans to try and read into. And there was an interview of her where she talked about how when she was younger, she used to like love reading the pamphlets with an album back to front to read the lyrics and all that type of thing, and how that's kind of fallen out of fashion in recent years with like the digitalization of music, and how she's always left Easter eggs to try and make fans still engage with like the physical format and engage with albums in a way that they might not do anymore because of streaming platforms. So I think that there's a back and forth with it. I think all of the fans aren't kind of crazy coming up with the theories, because she does constantly leave that information out there for people to try and interpret. And I think particularly with the gay theory, I guess that's more of a fan based theory than Easter eggs she's left, but she definitely is also aware of that. And like on the last album with the, not on the last album, on Folklore, she 100% knew that the controversy that was going to come out after she sang about someone with female pronouns, she definitely knew how the fans would respond to that, because she's a smart businesswoman. So I think there's a back and forth of it. I think it's all in good faith. In terms of fan theories that I think are a little bit crazy, maybe it's just my inability to understand numbers, but a lot of the Swifties online, the theories are like, if you add up the number of letters in this word with a number that's in the background of this video, you will find that this album is coming out on this day or whatever. All of that type of stuff completely goes over my head. So I do not understand it, where anyone comes up with any of that information, but it's fun. And yeah, I think, I don't know, I think with fan theories, I think there's a wholesome element to it. I think a lot of it, obviously you're going to have people who take things overboard, but I think there's a kind of a wholesome reason to be really invested in an artist and to just have fun with their music beyond just the music itself. It's fun to speculate and to put in that time with a release. And I don't think there's really much harm that comes from it. It's definitely, I think, one of the less harmful elements of fan bases. But yeah, I think in terms of like some of the funnier fan theories over the years, people saying that she was wearing like the Princess Diana like revenge dress after releasing a certain track, which was something that she then had to be like, no, that I was just wearing a black dress. But yeah, I think it's fun. I enjoy it. I don't know, I, as someone who engages with all of these fan theories all the time, I don't know if I necessarily believe any of the stuff that I'm drawing the lines between, but I think it's fun to mess about with, and it definitely keeps me invested. If you are like me and you're a big fan of TikTok and a big fan of Taylor Swift, you will find that 90% of your TikTok feed, particularly at the moment, is just Taylor Swift conspiracy theories and fan theories, which is stressful in one way, because for the last week my entire mind is just every single Taylor Swift song playing simultaneously, because that's what happens every time I go on TikTok. But it's fun. I think, you know, seeing it's got a sense of community around it, and it's nice to know that so many people are invested in this kind of lighthearted thing, in the same way as you are. And I liken it to supporting a football team or a sports club. It's just a really lighthearted thing to be really invested in when so much sucks in the world. So why not spend an afternoon obsessing over how the lyrics in Folklore, if you put them next to the lyrics of Evermore, you'll find that they match every single lyric. Yeah, but I enjoy it, and I will continue to overly scrutinize every single thing that Taylor Swift says until I get bored of it. So it's good fun.
Thank you, Kelly. You can listen to Kelly's music. She makes music under the name Gadget and the Cloud, and you can also read her in various places. Follow her on Twitter. And thank you again to Amelia. That is our episode this week. It's been strange not having Niall, but it has been nice. It just being us girls. You can support the podcast and indeed the Niall and Nine site, which needs you now more than ever. I don't think Niall would mind me saying. You can go to patreon.com/Niall9 to support, and that gives you access to the aforementioned Discord, as well as playlists,
and just lovely things, little newsletters. Yeah, just nice stuff. I've been Andrea Cleary. You can follow me at Andrea Cleary _ on Twitter and Instagram. And I have my own podcast, which is in between seasons right now. It's called My Favorite Album with Andrea Cleary. And you can find that on most, if not all, of your streaming platforms. Season 2 is returning in the new year. Thanks for listening. Stay Swifty.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.